That was good. I like that.
Oh, I forgot the pastor.
Yeah. That's My name is Russ Penn, a very grateful, recovering alcoholic turnip. Two barrels, okay. Well, we'll do what we can here. First of all, I need to thank you for your invitation. It's just an absolutely wonderful thing for Barbara and I to come up here and to share with you. And I've met a lot of you before. You've heard our story, and I'm sure you'll be patient one more time. But we know that you love us, and that makes a big difference in our lives. And you can be sure that that is a reciprocal feeling that I reach out every night in my prayers. And I always remember a lot of you by name because of the kindness and the love you've shown to us. You've helped us both grow in the program, and for that I know that we have to be very grateful. I thought being up here, you know, these few days, you ever hear such laughing? Such hugging and such joy and such peace that people express in their thoughts, and the fellowship that we have together is something that is absolutely phenomenal. I want to say a little bit more about that later, but first let me get to some of the most important things about the fellow who was so drunk all the time, and his family finally got sick and tired of it, and they decided they're going to do something about this. So he came home, usual pattern, soaked to the gills, and he drank, passed out. They took him out to the local cemetery, dug a hole, buried him with only his head sticking out, and they went home, left him there. And you know, the night passed, the next morning the sun was up and the birds were chirping, and he opened up his eyes and he said, "My God, it's resurrection day and I'm the first one up." The guy had a great spirit, didn't he? I guess as alcoholics, we've all gone through those stages of denial. We've done it openly and usually, at least in my case, I did a lot of denial inside myself. I didn't want to admit the things that I thought would bring a bad reputation to me. I didn't want to admit something that would cause me any type of problems in what I thought was a fine way of life. I really enjoyed myself when I was drinking. I loved it. I loved what booze tasted like. I loved what it did for me. And I felt like the king of the hill. There were times in my life when I didn't. I think as I grew up, some of you can relate, I'm sure, to that. Very insecure, feeling very unloved. Maybe the little kid on the block with all the pimples on the face and that kind of thing. And wondering if life would ever give me the opportunity to be somebody, because I love that more than anything else. And when the pressure started to come in my life, you know, to start admitting the fact, "Hey boy, you got a bad problem, you're alcoholic," I didn't want to face up to that. I remember reading about three clergymen who were arrested in a small town in the back room for gambling. And they were hauled before the magistrate the next day, and one by one he addressed them, and he spoke to the Roman Catholic priest first. He said, "Now, Father, I'd like you to tell me the truth. Were you gambling last night?" And the father just grabbed his little bead and he said, "The Holy Mother Mary of God, bless us sinners now and the day of our death." And he looked at Judge right now and he said, "Your Honor, I was not gambling." And he asked that Lutheran minister there, he said, "Now, Reverend, were you gambling last night?" And he said under his breath, "Well, let's see, now Jesus Christ died on the cross for my sins. I know that he forgave me if I tell a little white one." He looked the judge right in the eye and he said, "I was not gambling." And he turned to the third one, the Jewish rabbi, and he said, "A rabbi," he said, "were you gambling?" He said, "With whom?" Yeah. That's the way I felt about drinking. Who? Me? I certainly wouldn't want to do something like that. But there came a time in my life where everything started to fall apart. I got to the point that I was, you know, a quart a day. And I did this for years. And I just can't imagine to this day how I ever held up. But you see, alcoholics can do things that the average person may have a little difficulty getting away with. I could still function. I could still do my job. Over the years, with that heavy drinking, the last 2 years before I quit drinking, I was drunk every day. Most people did not know that. But strange things started to happen in my life. How would you like your pastor to come visit you in the hospital at 3 o'clock in the morning? I'd get up at that time of the day, you know, and I'd go visit those people. I'd say, listen, isn't it wonderfully nice and quiet here? Nobody's going to interrupt us and things like that. I'd be over to the office by 5 o'clock. I'd get done all the administrative work that I could, and then I'd disappear. And I'd go home and drink and enjoy my life. Now, we had those 8 children, and which goes to prove one thing in my mind, that preachers do a lot more than just preach on Sundays. Now, I figure that I've done 10 things right in my life. 8 of them I did because I was told to, and that's how we got to 8 kids. And the 9th one, I did because I had to, and that was to quit drinking, and the tenth thing I did because I wanted to, and that was that I joined AA and started believing and doing the best I could to practice the principles of the program. I don't think my story is exceptionally unusual beyond anybody else. We all have a little different twist as to what we did. But all of us can agree that the one thing that had a hold on us didn't want to let go, and that was alcohol. And our lives were unmanageable, and we could not control our drinking. I got to the point that I couldn't do that. But my story particularly is one of the egotistical, pompous little fella who was looking for power and who found it in the ministry as a pastor. People love their pastors usually. They put them up on a little pedestal and they hold them up there. And they think that they're probably the greatest things that are around. Because you see, have you ever seen such holiness, you know, that emanates? We're doing everything that we're supposed to do. And they get the impression that everything we do, we're doing because we sincerely and deeply love them. And I felt those things for my people. And when I drank and they began to catch on, boy, did they excuse me. They were some of the best enablers that I ran into in my whole drinking career. Some of them would see me acting like a fool out on the dance floor, you know, at a wedding reception, slipping around on that corn stuff, that cornmeal they show down there. And they would say, isn't Pastor having a wonderful time tonight? He deserves it. He works hard. And I felt that I was a good pastor to my people. I truly loved them, and I went out of my way to take care of them. Nobody in that church could ever sit back and say that this fellow ever neglected them, because I really worked for them. But see, there's a certain insidiousness in there, because I knew what the results would be. They would honor me, and they would respect me. I really got to the point that I had a problem with God. I really had a problem with Him. I used Him, and I abused Him, and I misused Him. And when it was convenient, I just dismissed Him from life. I felt kind of like God is really God. I can't deny that fact. But if there is anyone in this world who is right next in the pecking order, I'm the one. And I carried out my life that way. And I wanted Barbara to understand that, and I wanted the children to understand that. And when I drank just about anything I'd get my hands on, and I agree with that. My family could suffer want, and they did. I caused them to do that. And there were many times when other things would happen, but I always had enough to drink. And as time went by, it required more and more in order to do that. And when my tolerance finally, after those years, began to go down the old tube, one glass of beer could do it. And I was just simply and absolutely a dead duck. A lot of things were strange happening in my life. You know, I'd walk in the house and I'd wear this little collar, you know, that they wear. I'd walk in the house and Barbara would say, "Take that thing off, you hypocrite." And I would think to myself, I wonder what in the world's the matter with her? You know, what's gotten into that woman? I used to count my drinks, you see, because I had learned something about, and I heard something once about, you know, how you can control things if you really work at it. And I felt that I was drinking a little bit too much. But at any rate, you know, I would count my drinks, and I'd mark the bottles. I would hide them behind the soft drink bottles so they didn't know how much I did. And then if I thought they'd check up on me, well, I'd drink it down and fill it with water, you know, to be sure that they wouldn't get the impression I was drinking too much. I had blackouts. I slurred my speech. I couldn't write my checks. And nobody would knew that. Send the kids to the store, and they'd send them back and say, we don't understand what this is. Just all kinds of things like that. I used to do a lot of talking to myself. And I'd look in the mirror, you know, and I'd say, now, Russell, you know, you shouldn't be doing this. You're a man of God. You're a minister of the gospel. You're supposed to be preaching the good news. And why are you doing this? And I would answer myself and say, you're right. You ought not to be doing that kind of stuff. And many a night I would go up there and I'd look in that mirror at this ghoulish creature staring back at the face, you know, and I would tell myself, you know, Russell, you really are a hypocrite. You're a blasphemer. You're a deceiver. You're a betrayer of the trust that God has placed in you. And I would say, you're right. And I would promise God right on the spot, never again. Never again would I ever take another drink of liquor. And next morning I get up, beautiful day. God is a loving God. He forgives. That little episode of confession that I had was great, but He forgives. Let's have a drink to the glory of God. Boy, I used to sit in my East Room and I'd just drink all kinds of things. We'd have these fantastic storms up there in Illinois. You know, the lightning would be smashing outside the London. I'd be climbing and say, great bolt of lightning, God. That was absolutely beautiful. And I would drink to all, you know, all kinds of things like that. And the wind would blow, and I'd say, oh, how beautiful is the wind of God as it blows across the prairies here. I finally got to the point in my life, I felt terrible most of the time. From what I gather, I looked terrible. And I guess I started acting terrible. But the only thing that I could do through all of that period of time when alcohol got the best of me is that I was able to keep this ego of mine intact. And whatever became a threat to me, I would find some way to remove that. Well, I used to start giving money to the kids. Now, that's strange for me to do something like that because I didn't have anything to give them because I was using most of it for booze and we didn't have that money left over for anything else. I started to have more communion services in church. See, in a Lutheran church, we use wine. See, I started to have more communion services. And I'd always go to communion first. See, because there came a time in my life when, you know, when you're up there like this, how are you going to pass that cup around to the people if you weren't? So I always went first. I had a regular pattern for buying my booze. We had a congested area where we lived. They had five towns picked out, nice little beautiful circle. Once every fifth week, I'd stop in there. And incidentally, I always went to the Catholic liquor stores. Because those people were generous. I'd walk in, they'd say, well, hello, Father. And I'd lie to him, and I'd tell him, I said, listen, you know, the bishop and a couple of his cohorts are coming down for a party here at the place. I have to have plenty of booze on hand, you know, and stuff like that. And I always got a 20% discount, which is what I appreciated probably more than anything else. I caught on to that. Barbara told you about the wedding, and one morning I walked in the house after making my early morning hospital calls and taking care of everything, and my district president was there. And I thought to myself, well, how wonderful this is that he would come all the way out here to check up and see that I'm getting along okay. And then I found out that Barbara called him. I think she was angry with me and and put out with me. So he came out there, and boy, we sat down there. I just BS'd him right through that whole meeting that we had together there. And when he got done, he said, well, Russ, he said, why don't we just have a little prayer? I'm sure everything will work out fine. And I said, great. He said a real nice prayer that day. And he left. I never saw him again until I met him when I was in a treatment center. But he stuck by me. He stuck by me. And oftentimes, you know, when we look at people like us who have so deep problems with alcoholism, there's still something good there. There's still something that can be brought, and I think all of you here tonight that are alcoholics can testify to that fact. And if you don't want to, the rest of us will. That there's something grand that is still there that's getting smothered and drowned by all of the booze and everything else. I used to drive around drunk all the time. I never did get picked up, though. No drunk drivings or anything like that, you know. And I thank God when I got home. I started carrying booze with me to the pastor's conferences. Now, I don't know if you've ever gone to pastor's conference. That is a terrible place to go to. There's nothing worse than sitting around all day when you got a hangover listening to a bunch of preachers. Because, you know, they never know when to stop. But I used to carry mine. I used to carry mine with me in my briefcase or my luggage, whatever the case might be, and at break time, at lunchtime, in the evening, supper time, before I go to bed. And I'd invite the other pastors to come in here. Yes, they never did. So I said, the heck with them, I'll just do it myself. I took care of them. One of the exciting things that happened in our life together when I was really bad off is that one Saturday morning, and I remember this so clearly, one Saturday morning, it was after the little girl had second birthday party. I was sitting, well, I shouldn't say that. I was lying on the dining room floor, all dressed up, ready to go, no place to go. Minding my own business, just laying there. And Barbara came up and she gave me a kick. And I woke up and I said, what's the matter? She said, get up. We're going to the hospital. You are sick. Well, she had made arrangements again behind my back without asking. And she had a friend of hers who came over there. And those two put me in the car and they drove me 28 miles over to the Swedish American Hospital in Rockford, Illinois. And got on the elevator. Now listen, I've been around hospitals a long time. When you get on an elevator and there's no button for the floor where you're going, you know what's about to happen to you. Well, they were hauling me off to the psychiatric ward, and when we got there, sure enough, behind my back, of course, she had made the appointment with this Dr. Henry, who was incidentally a wonderful man. I love him to this day. And we got up there, and we went in and sat down in his office, and of course, Barbara was carrying on something fierce, crying. And he said, well, Barbara, what's the matter? And I just sat there, you know, mind my own business. And she carried on for an hour, and she cried. And you have to know her. You've never seen Barbara cry. I mean, that woman can really cry when she goes at it. I think she was really upset with me by this point. But anyhow, she told him how terrible I was and what I was doing. I was ruining her life. I was wrecking the lives of the kids. The church is going to fall apart. And she just didn't know what to do. And after about an hour, she finally wore herself out. And he looked at me and he said, well, Russell, he said, what do you have to say about all this? Well, I just sat back in that chair and I got my best clergy voice. And I talked to him, looked him right in the eye. And I said, Dr. Henry, you know, I'm really concerned about Barbara. So he kept her there. Yeah. he kept Barbara there for a whole month. If you ever want to find out, you know, if that doesn't help you to understand how alcohol is cunning and baffling and powerful, to take someone who has been so loving and so kind and such a wonderful wife and a wonderful mother and everything else. But you see, she became a threat to me. She became a threat to my drinking. I was not going to put up with that. And even Barbara, if necessary, had to go. While she was in the hospital, I did my homework. I went around to the important people in that church, and I told them, I said, now listen, I said, I want you to make me a promise. And they always make promises to me if I'd ask them. And I said, I want you to make me a promise. Now, Barbara's, you know, the cheese has slipped off her cracker. I said, now, you know, when she gets out, I want you to remember one thing. Do me a favor. You listen to her. You be kind to her. You love her. You don't talk to her about anything, but don't believe a word she tells you. And Barbara didn't tell you the whole thing. They never did from that day forward. She implied part of that, but They just simply, because I asked them to, just certainly eliminated her out of her life. You know, Barbara had started off in our marriage, and I love to say this part because she started off in our marriage as very beautiful and very bountiful and bouncy and all kinds of great stuff there, very benevolent. And during my drinking, she turned into a very bitchy, boisterous, belligerent individual. But you know something? That through the Al-Anon program and through the program of AA, we've changed a little bit. That Barbara has returned to that beautiful, benevolent, bouncy, and wonderful person. She thanks you for that, and I certainly do. I honor Barbara today, and I don't know how she put up with all that crap. I really don't, and so many of you other gals in Allen, how you put up with the crap that we just dispense along the way. I don't know how you did it. Except that there is a power greater than ourselves who helps restore us to sanity. And that's what happened. And I respect Barbara, and our children respect her for not only for what she for what she says, but for what she is. And that's the important thing. I adore her and love her deeply. She's a wonderful part of my life now, and a good part of my life. And she helps me a lot. And I've learned a lot of cute sayings from Al-Anon from her, too. That I can lay it right on her as well as she can on me, no. She says them online. You taught us how to deal with our problems. And if there's one thing that I could say, that when I finally got around to it, and it took me a long time, that you helped me to become teachable. That the ego can be put off to the side, you know, the pompousness can be put out of the way, and say, by golly, that's something I really need to learn, and that's something I really need to work at. We both learned from you that you cannot fly a kite without a string. And you can't steer a ship without a rudder. You have provided those things for us. We found out that it's not enough just to agree with the philosophy of AA and Al-Anon, but that we have to do something about it. It has to become a way of life. And so we try to live our lives every day with God's help and through the encouragement and the strength, you know, that you people continue to offer to us. I read a neat little story once about two Swedish people, a couple, a husband and wife. They've been married for 40 years, but all during those 40 years, you know, they were just feuding and fussing and fighting all the time, and they were on each other's case. And finally, after 40 years, it got to be too much. They decided among themselves, they said, maybe we ought to have a truce on this whole thing. So Olga said to Sven, she said, Sven, we've been fighting for all of these 40 years. I think it's time that we ought to pray God that he take one of us in death, and then I'll go live with my sister. That little story always reminds me that we dare never get selfish, you know. In that respect, I have yet to meet the individual whose life has been blown apart, who does not have some daily problems. Everything is topsy-turvy. And I would have gladly, prayed that prayer at one time, and I did. And I asked God, I said, I pray, God, to get that bitch out of my life, because she's an absolute embarrassment to me. And she doesn't know anything more to do with her life than harassment. And it never occurred to me that what I should be doing is asking God to help me to change my attitude so that I could do things better. I finally came to the point that I thought, can anything else go wrong? Can anything else go wrong than things that already happened? Well, by this time I had left that town. I went on that vacation. I conned the doctor into a little time off. I took off for South Carolina. I did some fantastic things over there in blackouts. I loved it. I resigned my position as a pastor. I found that letter 2 days later. I got it in my briefcase in the room. I read it every once in a while. It reminds me where I came from. And I wrote to my district president. I told him, I said, I really appreciate all the help that he gave me, and I'll be waiting. Expect in the return envelope an offer of another job. Told him exactly what I wanted. Never heard a word from him. I felt, what am I going to do with my life? I tried to get a divorce, and I called the lawyer. I made the mistake of calling the Lutheran lawyer, and they did what she said. They wouldn't pay attention to me. And I was in pretty bad shape. But you know, when you got a big ego, it says, nobody going to lick me. I can sit and look at that booze and say, you're not going to win. I can handle anything that life brings my way. And so my life continued to go that way. And I would tell myself, don't you ever forget that you're the king. Don't you ever forget that you're the superhuman one. Don't you forget that you're the boss. Don't let anybody get into you. Well, so you don't have a job. So your wife hates you. So your kids are against you. So your people in that church that you blew up hate you and think that you're a rat and so forth and so on. So is that so terrible? Have a drink. And that's what alcoholic thinking does to you. So I'd have another drink. My favorite book has this statement in it. I like to read it to you because I think it describes the alcoholic to a T. Do not look at the wine when it is red, when it sparkles in the cup and goes down smoothly. At the last, it bites like a serpent and stings like an adder. Your eyes will see strange things and your mind will utter perverse thoughts. You will be like one who lies down in the midst of the sea, like the one who lies at the top of the mast. They struck me, and you will say, but they did not hurt me. They beat me, and I did not feel it. What shall I do when I awake? I will have another drink. That's from the Bible. And that's where I was. But something happened to me on the 25th day of May in 1974. I had, after I blew everything, I never went back to that town incident. I left Barbara and the children and the church and everything else. I preferred my drinking to that. I went back to a 48-year-old man. I went back to Mommy. That's the place you go, isn't it, when you get in trouble? We alcoholics are good at that. Go to the people that are closest to you because they're supposed to understand. They're supposed to help. They're supposed to take care of us. They're not supposed to say anything, but just let us do what we want to. Relive the things that we did at one time. I was lying down in their basement on that morning, a Sunday morning, and it was a Sunday. I never forget that. I never even went out with a blaze of glory with my last drink. The day before, I cooked some steaks outside, had a couple of beers, went to bed at 8 o'clock. I knew something was wrong because I don't go to bed that early. And I don't go through a day without drinking that little. But that morning, I had to get up and go to church, of course. So I couldn't get out of bed. And there was nothing wrong with my arms, nothing wrong with my legs or anything like that. But two things had happened to me. This thing was gone. And this was gone. I had no more with which to fight. I had no more with which to continue to pretend that I was something that I really wasn't. And I said three words there that I thought might have changed my life at that time. I laid in that bed and I said, I need help. Isn't that marvelous? They hauled me off to Lutheran General Hospital up in Park Ridge, Illinois, locked me up behind bars with a bunch of dope addicts. And I told him, I said, you got this all wrong. I don't belong here. But then it dawned on me that since I had resigned my parish, that God was putting me in a whole new mission field, taking care of the dope addicts. And those of you who are professional or counselors, you would have probably bumped me out of my ear the first day because, I told him, I said, listen, if you folks got problems, I can see that. And if you just come on here and let's talk about this. And I said, if you do what I tell you, when you get out of here, you'll be fine. Everything will just be great. Well, I did that for a couple of days, made appointments with them and scheduled them and all that kind of stuff. And then the nurse came and she said, Russell, I want you to come with me. I said, where are we going? Oh, she says, we're just going to go to another part of the hospital. got on this elevator, zipped up to the 8th floor, got off, walked in this great big room about this size, and there was a bunch of chairs in a circle, a bunch of people sitting there whimpering and whining about the trouble that alcohol was causing them. And I told her, I said, I don't want to hear it. Went back downstairs. Next day, same thing. Come on, Russell, we're going to go take it. Well, I don't want to go. Well, come on, you don't have anything else to do. So I went. Only this time, did I have a surprise waiting for me? I got off the elevator. Judge, jury, executioner were there. There's Barbara sitting there. There's the psychiatrist waiting for me. There's the principal of my Christian day school, and there's my vicar, that rat of all people that I told you are loyal to me and to me only. And he was there. They took me in that room, cleaned everybody out. Those people circled me just like the old Indians got around the wagons. And they told me all these terrible things that I was doing with my life, how I was ruining everything. And I never forget old Art McElfresh was a social service worker there. He looked at me when they got done. He said, well, Russ, he said, what are you going to do about this? And I looked at him right in the eye. I said, well, I'll think about it. Wasn't ready to give in. Went back downstairs. Somebody said, hey, listen, that alcohol treatment center over there was a self-contained unit. They said, man, that is plush country club living. That's for me. I went over there on that Thursday, and I stayed there for 21 days. Walked in the first day, first meeting on the wall, they had the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I quickly scanned them, and I looked at them. I said, that's not good Lutheran theology. That's not for me. That may be for women and kids. People that have to do that stuff really have problems. But they told me, if you want to get better, and, you know, I kind of thought in the back of my mind, maybe I wasn't right with Barbara, you know, maybe I was a little hard on her at times. They said, if you want to make it, brother, you're going to work those 12 steps. That's exactly the way they put it to me. So I did. The first weekend, 36 hours, took care of all 12 of them. I did the fourth step in 15 minutes. That's all it took. My only defect of character was that sometimes I put down sometimes and underlined that sometimes Russell might drink too much. And on the other side, I put all the other side, I filled out loving, kind, generous, supportive, wonderful man. My counselor was there and I said, Carl, I'm ready for the fifth step. Took that thing about 5 minutes, you know, and he just laughed. He never said a thing, just laughed. And that weekend, let me tell you how I put my, I don't do things halfway. I read the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. I read that book, AA Comes of Age. I read Marty Mann's Primer on Alcoholism. And I even got down in that little technical book by Howard Kleinbell on alcoholism. That's about that thick. And I took notes on all of this stuff, you know. And when I went back to community group on Monday morning, I gave them a detailed report. And I told every one of them how they can work the 12 steps in 36 hours. And they wouldn't have to waste all their time doing that stuff. But there were a lot of good things that happened to me while I was there. My counselor told me, Russell, all the counselors had a staff, I guess they call it staffing. They got together and we decided that you're really zany. And I thought to myself, well, now, wait a minute. Zany means you're slightly crazy. No, I'm not going to accept that. So I went to the library they had there and looked it up in the dictionary. And sure enough, there's another definition for zany. And it's somebody who brings enthusiasm, excitement, and exuberance into the lives of others. And I thought, that's me. So I thanked him for that. He also told me when I was getting ready to leave, he said, you know, Russ, he said, you're the classic example of a middle-aged alcoholic. Well, first of all, I did not like the word alcoholic, so I forgot about that. And middle-aged, God has no age. But I love the word classic. See? You ever been called a classic drunk? Huh? Boy, I thought they know who's here. See, all the trouble I had been down, I've asked myself a dozen times by this time, you know, what the hell have you done with the wonderful, beautiful life God gave you? Don't you have any conscience? Don't you know of any? What is it with you? I just pass it off as if it were nothing. This is one tough nut to crack. I panicked when I went in there and they said, you know, there's possibility that you may never drink again in your life. I said, what? Because that's what I did best at that time. You know, you don't take the best away from a person. And I couldn't stand that thought anyhow. And then one of the guys came to me before we left, and he said, Russ, he said, you know, you're the philosopher of X group. And I like that. You're the philosopher of X group. Now comes one of my favorite stories, you know, about these two ladies, and it took me a while to catch on to what he was telling me, about the two ladies who went, came back after 25 years to class reunion. And one of them, you know, was all dolled up. She had the gems on, the furs and all that kind of stuff. And the other gal was very plainly dressed, and they started chatting back and forth. And the gal that was real wealthy looking, you know, she said, well, listen, do you know what my husband did for us when we got married? And she said, no, I don't. And she says, well, he took me on a 3-month cruise in the Mediterranean for a honeymoon. And her friend looked at her and said, oh, God, that's fantastic. And she said, do you know what he gave me for a wedding present? I said, no. I said, well, he bought me this brand new 17-room house, servants and everything. And her friend just gasped and said, well, that is really fantastic. And she showed her the big ring on her finger and said, you know, look at that, look at that. He just gave me that as an anniversary present. And her friend said, boy, that is really fantastic. She finally got off her case, and she asked her friend, he said, you know, how's your life been these 25 years? And the gal said, well, it's been okay, you know. Well, did your husband ever do anything special for you? She thought for a minute, and then she said, well, yes, he did. He sent me to charm school. And she said, well, what did you learn in charm school? And she said, I learned to say fantastic instead of bullshit. That's it. That's what he was telling me. He always telling me, you're full of it, coated all over and everything else, and I never see them. But they told me when I left the hospital, you go to 3 meetings a week or you'll never make anything. So I did. And here's where something started to happen in this egotistical mind of mine. There's 500 meetings plus in the Chicago area. I picked out the 3 meetings where all they did was discuss the 12 steps. That was when my salvation started. And I would go in there and I would sit in the corner. And they'd say, won't you come up and sit by the table with us? I said, I don't want to. I had to work through some terrible shame in this time in my life. I had to work through terrific guilt. I had to work through that tremendous sense of unworthiness, and the words of Barbara would keep coming back. How dare you stand in that pulpit and preach the word of God, you hypocrite? And she'd say, aren't you terrified to do that? And I'd say, and I was. Because I was really hurt. I've never hurt as much in my life as I did getting over that sickness I had. It still bothers me. And I got out of there and I went to my parents' house. I went out, worked in the garden. I got a nice suntan, bought me a new pair of shorts and a nice top, you know, summer wear. And I just remember Barbara said, Russell, if you quit drinking, everything would be fine. So I thought, I'm going to look her up and see what happened to her. So I found her out in Cincinnati in the little shack. And I walked up. My story's a little bit different than hers, the way we greeted here. I tell you, I walked that door and knocked on that door, you know, and she came and stood there in the screen door like this. And she said, well, what can we do for you? And I thought to myself, what's the matter with her? She's the one who said, if you just quit drinking, everything would be fine. You see, I expected her, because I had gone through treatment and everything else, I expected Barbara to just welcome me back with open arms and to say, you wonderful, wonderful person, and to forgive me on the spot. See, that's one of the first things they taught me when I got in the program. They said, now listen, Russ, you know, you got to forgive yourself. And I did, the first night, wiped the whole slate clean. I always do everything in a big way, wiped the whole slate clean right away. But she had trouble with that. And I discovered that you cannot get divine forgiveness out of a human being. And we need to learn that in the program. We have to give our families, those people that we hurt so deeply, we must give them a chance to get better also. I hung around there. She got mad at me a number of times. She kicked me out. I got a job working in a little machine shop. Two of us, we were making stakes for the Alaskan pipeline. And I thought, boy, this is great. Wonderful. And something happened to me in the machine shop, and that was where it turned, my life turned around. I can't explain it to you. It just happened. Remember the story of the prodigal son? Right in the middle of that story, four words, he came to himself. And that was it. All the good things that you people in AA taught me or tried to when I was in treatment and all that kind of stuff at the meetings is finally started to register a little bit. And then God did something wonderful in my life. He put a robe on me, put a ring on my finger, the shoes on my feet, killed the fatted calf. And it was like in that moment that God reached down and he put his big arms around me and he said to me, "Welcome home, my friend. Welcome home to the land of the living." My life has been going up ever since. I can't explain that to you, but that's the way it happened to me. And I never forget that. And then I was so happy because of that change. Then I lost my job. And I thought, geez, you know, I got to go do something about this. And I love to be in the ministry. I want to assure I don't abuse it anymore. Thank you. I don't abuse it anymore. And I wanted to do that again. So I went to see a fellow pastor in Cincinnati who's supposed to be a, quote, expert in this field. And we sat and talked. You know what he told me? He said, "You might just as well forget it." He said, "You'll never make it. You'll never get back in the ministry, especially in the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod, which is sort of a conservative type of church body." I was absolutely crushed. And I went home and I was down in the dumps. You know, the only thing that saved me is I got to my meetings. And they'd pick up my spirits as soon as I'd walk in the door. Guess what happened shortly thereafter? I got two calls back into the ministry, one to Erlanger, Kentucky, the one down to Enterprise, Alabama. And Barbara and I talked about that, and I thought to myself, well, maybe the smartest thing to do is get away from the scene of my crimes. So we left and took the one down in Enterprise, Alabama. George Wallace and Rednecks, that's all we knew about the place. Went to Alabama. And before I left Cincinnati, I drove past that wonderful pastor's house. And I gave him the finger. And, you know. Oh, jeez. That was... I couldn't resist it. Because he was trying to tell me something and know that it can't be done, and he did not know the power that God has given to the program of AA and to the exceptional people that are in it. I'll never forget when my sponsors and seed said, "Russ, you just hang in there. You watch it happen." And that's exactly what happened. We need to believe that. You know, I think that the program has an element there where you got to have faith. You know that little poster, don't you? That little tiger's hanging on there to rope. It's hanging on that rope for dear life, and it says, "Hang in there, baby. Let go of the rope." That's faith. That's faith. When everything looks absolutely hopeless and you don't think nothing can happen, it will if you got the faith. So I have that kind of faith because I believe that behind every word in all the 12 steps, there stands the finger and the hand of God himself. The higher power whom I choose to call God, who will restore us once again to sanity. I don't believe that I can solve all my problems anymore by drinking. And I don't believe that, you know, knowing that if I did drink that I'd get stupid drunk and I'd get in all kinds of trouble. I no longer believe that I can still do that and still work. It doesn't work, and it never will for me. I don't deserve what happened to me. I don't deserve getting better, but it happened. I'm grateful to God for that. And I thank God that I didn't get what I deserved. But I have it today partially, and I cherish it today, and I got a long way to go, and I'm going to work at it one day at a time. So I feel this way about life now. I'm happy. in my life with my family. I like the little church that I'm privileged to serve. I love the people in the church very much too. Not as much as I do you, but don't tell them. You could take all of your materials, all your material things, and you can take the honor and the adulation and the respect. And incidentally, I still get that, but I know how to handle it now. And I'm just grateful for that. But you give me sobriety with contentment, and you keep all the rest. Okay? It's a good deal. Keep all the rest. It wouldn't make that much difference as far as I'm concerned. I will never trade off what you have given me through this program for anything else. AA has given me life, and God has used people like you to get this egotistical person to back off from life and to say, I still need help, and to be grateful because I still receive that help, and to be able to say that I love you very, very much for helping me. Well, what have I learned through all of this? You're supposed to tell us, sir, what's happening today. Every bird whistles through his own beak. I love that statement. Every bird whistles through his own beak, and same is true in AA program. I can look at you, and I can see the good things that have happened in your life, and I relate to what Natalie was telling us about last night and all those good things. But I can't be her. I can't be you, Jim. I have to be what I am. And I am a person who has been gifted by God who does not have to take a drink today. I'm a person who gets up in the morning and I have a choice and I don't have to be like any of that. I'm in a position today where I can say that I'm doing what I think needs to be done in my life. And I'm feeling better about it because the choices that I'm making today seem to be better than they were years ago. And I'm becoming a worthwhile and I think a worthy human being. And I'm becoming worthwhile and worthy to other people. My sponsor in Cincinnati told me, he said, you know, Russ, we have an H of a program. So let me quickly run down the line. First of all, there's help. Anybody that has drinking problem, if they want help, it's there in the AA program. We got to, you know, we take care of any bottom that comes along. Anyone, doesn't make a difference. I ever tell you about that little kid, the guy that went fishing, you know, he caught this 9-inch fish and he took it off the hook and put it in his creel. And then he caught the 6-inch fish, he took that one off, put it in the basket. Caught the big lunker, 20-inch long, took it off the hook, threw it back in the lake. The little kid looking, hey, mister, why'd you keep the little fish and throw the big one back in? He says, they only got a 10-inch skillet. Yeah. We have a skillet that'll fit any bottom. Any bottom, it'll fit. A thing called honesty. And stop me if any of you want to challenge this statement that all of us needed that. To be honest with ourselves for the first time. A thing called humility. And that thing has really helped me. It's helped me to recognize my own limitations. I cannot be what I'm not or who I'm not. Basic to all of our humility that we gain in the program is gratitude to God. When you start out being grateful, you started out on the right foot. Then there's another thing, you know, that is called humor. Boy, can we laugh about some of these dumb things that happened years ago. I remember once when I was just kind of minding my own business there at the church I was at in Illinois, and the elders were in there. We were just chatting back and forth, and one of the guys said, you know, there's a guy that rides around town on his bicycle in the wee hours of the morning. I said, you know, and some nut. And they said that the cops are looking for him. I quit, boy. I got off the bike, and that was the end of that. That was one of the things alcohol did for me, boy. Put me on the bicycle. And I get out there roaring around the town all kinds of hours in the morning. I will laugh about that stuff. It wasn't funny then. But thank God that we have this gift of humor in the AA program. There's a thing called humanity. Now, I notice a few of you today, you know, you call me pastor, but I know you did it in a lot of fun. I thank you for giving me my name back. A lot of the people in my church call me Russ, or they call me Russell, among other things. But that's okay, and I thank you deeply for that. I used to instruct people about how to address me. One guy did that after church one Sunday morning. Man, I took that guy off to the side. I said, you don't talk to me like that. That's not my name. When I took the call and put the robe on, I have a different calling in that. So he did that, okay? Hope. Don't ever give that up. Boy, that is a wonderful thing. Remember the story of Pandora's box? She opened the box, all the evil flew out. And that's what we alcoholics were great at. Boy, we just opened those boxes, all the evil we visited upon other people. And most people emphasize that, you know. But did you know that when all that was done, that there was still something left in Pandora's box? Hope. I know I'll never give up, because I know what hope is now. And I hope, you know, I have that hope that tomorrow is going to be even better than today. And then the last one I like is hanging on. You just keep hanging on and doing the things that are right. Stay with the winners. I don't want to hang around with people that aren't winners. I'll talk to them, but I don't want to hang around with them because there may be a little danger there. Get around the winners and stay with them. You know, there's no greater time in my life than to be with people like you. It's a wonderful experience in my life. I really cherish that. I've also learned, you taught me something that I had a terrible time with, and that's loving people. You know, I thought they were just there, you know, to be my servants or to be at my command or whatever. You know, I could stand in front of a group here and say, I can feel it right down inside. I really love you. And to say that, I mean like I never could ever say it before. It gets down and tingles my toes. So I need to thank you for that too. And the fellowship, you won't know. None of my church members here. You'll never find a fellowship like this in the church. I'm serious. I mean that very seriously. And I don't mean to denigrate any churches or anything like that. We have one thing in common that keeps us together, whether we have met each other before or not. Try to take a bunch of strange church people and put them in a group like this and see what happens. They all got their own special sins they're messing around with. They can never get together. Right? We have something that keeps us going, and I'm very grateful to them. I'm going to keep making it. Just a couple of little stories and then I'm done. I'm about these three clergy couples that went off to a conference. And they had a real wonderful conference. They were traveling by car, three couples on the way home, bad accident, all six of them killed. Naturally, clergymen assume they're going to go straight to heaven, I'm sure. But anyhow, when they got up there, the first couple got there, they walked up and St. Peter said, "What is it that you want?" They said, "Well, you know, we're here." And he looked at that clergyman, he said, "Now, wait a minute." He said, "You may have been able to fool those people down there, but you can't fool us. We know what goes on. We know how on Sundays you would dip your hand in the offering basket and fill your own pockets." And he said, "On top of that, that woman you married this woman named Penny." And the next couple came, you know, and they said, "We're ready." He said, "Wait a minute. You may have fooled those people down there, but you can't fool us. We know how you used to sneak around with all that drinking of yours and how you were drunk most of the time. And on top of that, look at that woman you married. Her name is Brandy." And just about that time, the third guy, he turned to his wife and he said, "Come on, Fanny, let's get out of here. We'll never make it." I don't have to call Barbara Fanny because I know I'm going to make it. You can't help when you got the support and the love and everything of people like you. You know, it's going to work out okay. And then I've learned something too. That you've taught me that if I don't give away what I have, I'll lose it eventually. And that's true. It'll mold. It'll just rot within us. And all we will do will just become very, parrot people sitting back, you know, recite the 12 steps or something. That you got to give it away to somebody else. That's why, you know, I don't mind going around talking and listening and stuff like that, because I'm giving away what you have given to me. It will absolutely choke me to death if I don't. So I go any place, anywhere, anytime that I'm available in order to say, "Here, I need to give you what you have first given to me." And then let me read to you a little thing I came across, this kind of little model that you've taught me to. Seeking to care and daring to give, before I die, I will finally live. That is neat. That summarizes some of the things that I have learned in the program. Now to wrap it all up with my story about the grasshoppers. I love those stories about the grasshoppers. About two grasshoppers that fell in this bowl of thick, rich cream. And the one grasshopper said, "Oh my God, am I ever in trouble here? What am I going to do?" And you know, he just kept fuming and fussing about all the trouble. "I'm going to drown." And guess what happened to him? He kept that up and he drowned. But the other grasshopper fell in. He said, "Holy smokes, am I ever in trouble? I better do something, and I better do it fast if I'm going to get out of this thing alive." So he just kicked up his heels, and he just kept singing his grasshopper song. And the first thing you know, he turned that cream into butter, and he walked away to safety. When we come in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, we can be like the first grasshopper. And we can just wallow around there and feel sorry for ourselves and get on our pity pot. And incidentally, when you sit on your pity pot, all you do is get a ring around the hind end. That's all you get out of it. You sit on the pity pot. And that's the way we'll drown. We'll lose it. We'll miss it. Or we can be like the second grasshopper. We can just kick up our heels and do what we're told to do, and we can keep singing the song of the 12 steps, and the first thing you know, you can turn that stuff around and you walk away safely every day into a new, beautiful, wonderful life. I have that by the grace of God and through your help. Thank you very much for having me over tonight.